Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 83, recorded Friday, May 28th, 2010. This is the podcast that gives the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: traveling in India and first impressions, iPad versus netbook. Well, I'm coming to you today from the business class toilet on an American Airlines 777 flying somewhere north of the Iceland volcano. I'm returning from my first trip to India after spending 2 days each in Gurgaon, Pune, and Bangalore. I got on this nonstop flight back to Chicago, left Delhi at 12:15 Thursday night, and I should land some 14 hours later in O'Hare at 4:30 Friday morning if all goes to schedule, and the computer is calculating the time correctly that they're showing up on this TV screen. I'll talk about more about my India trip in the first topic, but for now I think I'm going to get out of this John before somebody thinks I'm doing something strange in here. Not that recording a podcast in the bathroom is normal for anyone that is, except me. Okay, so I'm back now in the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago. I landed safely and am now spending the rest of the day trying to get my body clock reset. You know, the first time I flew home from Asia, I arrived before I took off. I left Tokyo around 5 p.m. and got into San Francisco airport around noon. You know, that made my brain hurt just a little bit trying to figure it out. Now, I just roll with it. You know, flying to Europe, I make a point to get on the destination time right when I sit in the airplane seat. Flying to Asia, that just takes too much work. I just sleep when I want and eat when I want and leave it to my iPhone alarm to help me power through the consequences. Hey, one more quick India note. I was standing in line to board my return flight. We had run the gauntlet in the jetway of repeated security questions. Has your carry-on been out of your possession at any time? And another wanding and pat-down. And now waiting to board, when I heard a guy describing the scene to someone on his mobile phone, it took me about 20 seconds for it to hit me. I recognized that voice. I turned around, and about half a dozen people back was a guy I had worked with 6 years ago. Now, I'm used to running into friends and former colleagues at O'Hare and LaGuardia, but Delhi? It's either a really small world, or I know way too many people who fly. Following up, we've talked in past episodes about ways to find good restaurants on the road. I've mentioned chowhound.com, a popular foodie forum is one of my main tools, but Twitter has also become very useful. The last time I was in LA, I couldn't figure out what I wanted to do for dinner, so I tweeted, "What should I eat? Sushi or In-N-Out Burger?" Now, a lot of responses came out, "Well, In-N-Out Burger, you can get sushi anywhere." And then one follower replied, "Try Kogi Barbecue Truck." Well, what a great idea. I'd read about these guys a few months prior, some guys running three taco trucks doing some, you know, mashup of Korean and Mexican food, you know, things like kimchi quesadillas, and they tweet every day the locations of their trucks. So I hit Twitter, found the closest truck, it was about a 30-minute drive, and headed out. I found it and queued up with about two dozen other Angelinos, passed an Arco gas station, ordered up some tacos, and ate them on the hood of my car. It was great, and I just wouldn't have thought about it without somebody responding to my tweet. And then the best meal on my last trip last month to Seattle was courtesy of Twitter. Ed Learned saw where I was and suggested the Steelhead Diner, and I ended up with another great meal. And, I think this is how the whole social media thing is supposed to work. You know, we each help each other find stuff that we wouldn't normally find. Now, another thing that's worked for me this year, on a completely separate note, is hand washing. When all the panic about H1N1 virus started up, I ignored most of it. except for the talk about the benefits of extended hand washing. 20 seconds with soap and water, they said, was more effective than all those little bottles of Purell. Okay, I decided to give it a go, investing a little bit more time under the faucet and a little bit more sort of agitation with the soap. One day, at the beginning of April, as Chicago began to warm up, it came to me. I haven't had a cold this season. Now, for the first time in as long as I can remember, in spite of doing the same amount of cohabitating metal tubes with sick people, inhaling their recycled exhales, I didn't get sick. I mean, this was a first time in a long time. I guess this hand washing thing works. What else? I broke down and tried GoGo's in-flight Wi-Fi a few months ago. Now, I'd like to say that I did it purely from an investigative standpoint so that I could report to you, my podcast listeners, on all the ins and outs. But actually, I had a half day in Phoenix, was racing to make the flight, and still had a bunch of emails that I wanted to get out before the end of the day. So rather than queuing up 25 emails and then blasting them out when I hit O'Hare, I ponied up for GoGo. So here's my bottom line. GoGo in-flight Wi-Fi is a pig. A slow one. And it's not even so much the bandwidth to the ground, just the response time from the web server in the plane, airborne.gogoinflight.com. I don't know, maybe because it was a full plane with lots of laptop-toting professionals needing to get online in the middle of the day, but still, come on. When I first connected to the buy page, and by the way, it took me a while for it to get there, the price was $10 for the flight. But then the in-plane server timed out, so I had to start again from the start. Great user experience. And that user experience just got better because the second time I got to the buy page, it was $13. Now, I ponied up because I needed it, but I tell you, I haven't used GoGo since. I don't know. Maybe it was a goofy day on that flight, though. I mean, on the same flight, the guy next to me tried to buy a cheese and cracker snack with cash and then was, should I say it? Should I say it? No, I shouldn't, but I will. He was cheesed off. That American no longer takes cash. I'm amazed. Like, when was the last time this guy flew? And finally, listening this week to the World's Technology podcast, I heard about the death of John Shepard Barron, the inventor of the ATM, the automated banking machine. Like, for the business traveler, the ATM revolutionized our lives as much, if not more, than mobile phones. I mean, I remember traveling before ATMs were ubiquitous. You'd pay American Express a chunk of change for a wad of $100 traveler's checks, and then spend a good bit of your trip getting ripped off by currency exchanges and airports, and cutting out of meetings on midday Friday to go hunt down a bank before it closed so you'd have some cash for the weekend. I mean, it took a lot of planning ahead. Now, I contrast that to this last weekend. On Sunday, I woke up in Gurugan, wandered around to the mall next door, found a Citibank ATM a couple hundred feet from the front door, punched in a few keys, and out popped 10 crisp 500 rupee notes. And without taking much note, I now had a bit of cash with which I could buy a cup of masala tea. So, John, thanks for your invention. Hey, if you've got a question, a story, a comment, a travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send them along. The email address is comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com, or you can send me a Twitter message at mpeacock, or you can post them on the website at travelcommons.com. The first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is business travel in India. Longtime Travel Commons listener Mark Lowerwald came back to me in the midst of my tweet stream from India asking, are you collecting some stories for a new Travel Commons episode? I mean, even without trying, I came back with some. Deplaning at Indira Gandhi International Airport, IRI to the local cab drivers, was pretty uneventful, though the immigration officer did comment that I looked much younger in my passport picture. After a 15-hour flight, I'd have been surprised if it was any other way. I told him, it's not the years, it's the mileage, but I think he was a bit young to catch the Indiana Jones reference. Getting out of our hotel, I had the first of many security screenings during my stay. At every hotel and major building, I walked through a metal detector, was wanded down, and had my briefcase x-rayed. I mean, the whole exercise took 90 seconds, and the employees were exceedingly polite,
because they work for the hotel, not some overblown government agency. But given what happened in Mumbai a year and a half ago, I mean, you know, the security was understandable. Sunday afternoon, I was back at IRI, but this time at the domestic terminal for a flight on Kingfisher Airlines. Yes, that's owned by the same person as Kingfisher Beer, but no, it's not served on board. All domestic flights in India are non-alcoholic. So anyhow, I was catching a flight on Kingfisher from Delhi to Pune. I walk up to the door and am stopped by a security guard, polite, but not as polite as the hotel guys, asking to see an itinerary. I have an e-ticket, I say, so I don't have an itinerary. No paper, no entry. He points down the terminal to the Kingfisher desk and says they can print it out for me. So 10 minutes and a bit of aggressive line jockeying, and I was back with the necessary piece of paper, a printout of my flight itinerary. Now I can go in. Now, that did feel a little bit like, you know, some security theater, because I could have, you know, given any sort of PC, I could have created my own flight itinerary and just printed the damn thing out. So, you kind of wonder about these things. So anyhow, I go in, and then I face more security. Going through security screening, everybody kept on their shoes and belt, but then everyone was wanded and everyone was patted down after passing through the metal detector, whether it beeped or not. Every carry-on had to have a tag, which was stamped after x-raying. Now, these tags were then checked by another security guard as you boarded the plane. So after the Kingfisher gate agent checked you in online, before you could get to the jetway, there is another security agent standing at the door checking the tags on your handhelds, making sure that they were stamped, indicating that you had indeed passed them through the x-ray machine. No stamp, and back you went to security. Now, Leo Vigoda, another Travel Commons listener, responded to my security line tweet asking, is the line still 2 hours long? Well, no. I mean, even with all this extra security, the lines weren't long. They just, I don't know, there seemed to be enough staff to handle it. I don't know, perhaps I was traveling at non-peak times, or I don't know, perhaps their staffing algorithm is better than the TSA's. But what struck me most, and it sort of came to me by the middle of the week, was how isolated my travels were. And now, in past Travel Commons episodes, we've talked about the travel bubble that business travelers inhabit, seeming to sort of float above the day-to-day activities of a given city, sort of, you know, kind of like Glenda the Good Witch in Wicked. I just seem to be full of random pop references today. Now, in India, I was in an extreme travel bubble, eating breakfast in the hotel, taking a private car to my meetings, then driven to dinner, which was usually in a hotel restaurant, and then finally dropped off at my hotel, if the restaurant wasn't already in my hotel, at about sort of 9 or 10 p.m. But unlike everywhere else, I wasn't trying to escape the travel bubble. Now, I don't think it was poverty or a concern about security. I mean, I've dealt with that in places like Johannesburg and Rio. It was something else, but I didn't know what it was. And then finally, toward the end of the week, looking out the car window one day on one of my many rides, I realized what was different in India. And it was the crowds, just the massive people. Everywhere I was, everywhere I looked, there were just huge numbers of people moving to and fro, much more than I've seen anywhere else. And even way into the night, those masses, those people moving, it never let up. Now, I don't know, maybe all the extra security got to me subconsciously, and I don't know, but and I'm sure in time that I would have gotten comfortable with the crowds, but the pace of the trip, 3 cities, 7 days, 15 hours a day in meetings, and then another 3 hours back in the room catching up on things back home, I just never got situated. I never got comfortable with where I was. Now, when I finally fell out of the travel bubble, it was right at the end of my trip, transiting between the domestic and international terminals at Delhi. It was a 30-minute bus ride, but the security wouldn't let me on because I had forgotten to print my American Airlines itinerary. So, and it's not walkable. Like I said, it's, you know, the terminals are completely disconnected. So I had to go outside and catch a cab. Now, not a car, not a minibus, but a regular street cab. So careening through the streets, I remember the story one of my hosts told me a few days past about how he had taken a cab between these two terminals, and the cab had gone off to the side street, and he had been blocked, and then he had been blocked in by three other cabs. A guy comes into the cab and says, "Give me all your money." And he only ended up getting out of there after he gave him $100, which he thought he came away pretty cheap. So that's in my mind. I'm watching the street signs. Like, why isn't he taking that exit to the airport? And then he goes down and around the support pillars of the expressway, past a strip of hotels with neon signs. We're sort of driving in this sea of motor scooters. Finally, we emerged in front of the access road to the international terminal. A couple more jigs and jags. I'm watching out the window, and it makes sense. He's avoiding construction. And then finally, we're unloading my bags in front of the terminal. I tip the driver 200 rupees on a 250 rupee fare, and then walk through the door and slip back inside my travel bubble. The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is iPad versus netbook. Now, at the beginning of the month, I swapped my standard corporate-issued Dell Latitude E6400 Battleship Gray laptop for an HP Mini 5102 netbook running Windows 7 and an Apple Wi-Fi plus 3G iPad. Now, after trips to Scottsdale in India with my lighter briefcase, lighter by 1.4 pounds, the combination of those two weighs almost a pound and a half less than the Dell, I found myself liking both devices, but for very different reasons. Now, the main reason I was willing to dump the 14-inch Dell screen for a 10-inch netbook display is that most of my computer time is now spent running email. Now, back when I was developing code or creating PowerPoint decks, I was willing to lug some extra pounds to get some extra pixels. But, you know, now that my life revolves around Outlook, screen size isn't as important, but a good keyboard is. And the HP's traditional keyboard is much more usable for a touch typist than the iPad's on-screen keyboard. I mean, you can't rest your fingers on the iPad's virtual keys, and Apple, sort of by eliminating the semicolon key, which, understood, you know, don't use it that often, but it causes some real problems for touch typists. Also, being able to work in the actual Outlook client on the HP, looking at other people's schedules and setting up meetings, browsing shared Exchange folders, I mean, that's a huge advantage over the iPad's mail client. So HP is the clear winner with email. Now, even though the HP's screen specs out larger than the iPad's, it's sort of, you know, 10.1 inches diagonal for the HP versus 9.7 inches diagonal for the iPad, I mean, the iPad's screen just looks bigger and certainly is brighter. I don't know, perhaps it's the fact that it's got 132 pixels per inch, just to spin the propeller for a second, but I think more so it's probably because the iPad's tablet form factor frees it from the desktop or from your lap and makes it seem natural to bring it closer to your eyes. And if you're browsing rather than typing, touching the website is a more direct interaction than connecting your fingers to the cursor through a touchpad or a mouse. I mean, unless that is your browsing involves websites like Hulu, which lands you directly in the crossfire of Steve Jobs' flash jihad. Now, but for non-flash web browsing, the iPad is the clear winner. Now, when I'm writing, the best keyboard wins out. And while I'm getting better on the iPad's virtual keyboard after a month or so practice, I've switched over to the HP's physical keyboard to write this episode after starting on the iPad. Now, a couple of folks have suggested that I use a Bluetooth keyboard with my iPad, but I'll tell you, one of my travel principles is to travel with the least number of electronic things as possible. Having lots of electronic bits show up on the X-ray screen makes any TSA screener twitchy, and it significantly increases the probability of a hand search, something that any frequent traveler wants to avoid. Now, it's also easier to get files on and off the HP. I mean, the iron sandbox that Apple has erected around the iPhone and now the iPad may improve its security, but I'll tell you, it makes it difficult to use it as something other than an isolated machine. Now, this didn't feel like such a problem with the iPhone, but you really notice it, or at least I really notice it with the iPad. I mean, when I'm creating a document that's more than a few lines between the keyboard and, you know, file transfer, I just find myself switching to the HP all the time. Moving from Dell's 2.26 gigahertz Core 2 Duo processor, again, to spin the propeller a little bit, moving from that, you know, kind of mainline processor to the 1.66 gigahertz Atom chip that's in the HP netbook, I mean, you'd expect to wait a few more seconds for applications to start up. Just makes sense. And you do. But if you're doing, you know, if you're just doing email, web browsing, some light Word, Excel, PowerPoint, you know, the Atom keeps up fine. It's, you know, it's certainly not winning any speed races, but it's fine. It's horses for courses. You know, I'll tell you, though, there are no such compromises with the iPad's custom A4 chip. I mean, video is smooth, screens snap, and there's none of that stutter step scrolling that, you know, has become so frustrating on my 3G iPhone. I'll tell you, from a user experience standpoint, the iPad's performance just smokes the HP. Now, probably the biggest disappointment, though, with the HP is the battery life. I mean, the 4-cell battery specs out at 4.5 hours, but it was dying after my 3.5-hour flight from Chicago to Phoenix. Now, I don't know. It could be that I just don't have Windows 7 configured correctly, but I couldn't get much more battery life even after some deep sort of power option tweaking. Now, my experience with the iPad's custom battery is the complete opposite. I mean, I've yet to see the battery gauge turn red. I mean, even after pretty constant use on my 15-hour flights to and from India, I'll tell you, that is a very pleasant change from the usual iPhone experience. And then finally, you know, as I thought about cost, a straight feature cost comparison between these two is tough. I mean, they're very different machines. Comparing the two machines in my briefcase, the HP 5102 mini netbook with 2 gigabytes of memory and 160 gigabyte hard drive, it lists for $535 on HP's website. You know, compare that to my 64 gigabit Wi-Fi plus 3G iPad, which goes for $829 on Apple.com. HP looks the winner, absolutely. But if you factor in the delta between the price of a typical cellular data plan, which you choose for the HP, get it from Sprint or AT&T or Verizon, now you compare that plan with the iPad's 3G plan from AT&T, which is at a lower cost. So if you take that delta, and then if you can drop down to a 32 gigabit Wi-Fi plus 3G iPad, well, after 12 months, the savings from the 3G plan versus the PC plan, you're going to break pretty close to even after 12 months, which, I mean, you know, you're going to own it for at least 2 years. Now, is that a comparison? You know, I don't know, but it's a data point. And so depending on your choices there, from a cost comparison standpoint, the HP might be the winner, or you might be able to push it to sort of a, you know, to a toss-up. So what's the bottom line? You know, it's not clear, but I'll tell you what, I really like both machines, but as I said before, as I've outlined here before, for very different reasons. The HP is a solid little machine, great keyboard, reasonable performance, and a compact size that doesn't get crushed when the guy in front of me pushes his seat back on an American Airlines MD-80. The iPad, though, provides a much better way to browse websites, not non-flash websites, of course, and to watch videos. I mean, I'd love to drop one of them, but since the TSA doesn't make me take my iPad out before X-raying, I'm not in too big of a hurry. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 83. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Thanks to everybody who's sort of hung in with me. Sorry about that, but I'll tell you, this new CIO job has just consumed all of my spare cycles. The bridge music for this show is from Magnatune, the We Are Not Evil label. We Are Complex by Curl, Crazy by Beth Quist, and Blues for a Rainy Day by Mark Cook. You can find links to these in the show notes, and you can find these songs and more at Magnatune.com. Hey, if you have a story, a thought, a comment, a gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or MP3 file to comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com, or you can at me. I don't know what the verb for sending a, you know, sending a message to someone on Twitter is, but you can at me, I guess, at M Peacock on Twitter, or post them on our website so everybody can read them at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who's taken the time to send in emails, to tweet me, I think, and to post comments on the website. Again, thanks for you guys' patience. I don't know when the next show is going to be, but just keep subscribed to iTunes, and when I can cut loose a few cycles, I'll cut a new episode, and it'll pop right down into your iPod, kind of like this one did. But until then, take care, safe travels, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.
Life is hell, strange bed in a lonely motel. But one thing needs my mind, the one woman that I left behind. From California to Carolina, she calls me up and there's nothing in front.